John chooses a very powerful Greek word to tell us what he did. Verse 3 says, he left Judea and departed again into Galilee. In the Greek has it says he let it go. He let Judea go. You know, brothers and sisters, the worst thing that could ever happen to you and I is for God or his Son to let us go. When God's got hold of you, though we may have trials and tribulations, just so long as he's got hold of us, he may squeeze us very powerfully to direct us, to discipline us, brothers and sisters. We can bear that, and we must bear that. But if he lets us go, then we're in real trouble. We're in dire straits if he does that. And that's exactly what Jesus did. And when he heard those Pharisees and the intent that they had, he dropped Judea. And he went into Galilee. And to go to Galilee, he went through Samaria. And in Samaria, brothers and sisters, they rushed out to welcome him. And dozens of people believed on him, and he never did a single miracle. And some of them believed indirectly through a woman who'd never spoken to them. Couldn't get that in Judea. He never got that sort of response down there. And unless he brought down fire from heaven, unless he healed the sick, gave sight to the blind, strength to the lame, they wouldn't believe a thing. But up in Samaria, brothers and sisters, they even believed him indirectly. He let go Judea. And he took hold of Samaria and Galilee. That's what the record says. And John says he must needs go through Samaria. Why must he needs go through Samaria? The Greek means of a necessity. To be forced by circumstances. Again, a strong word. So what the record is saying is this. That John's telling us, if using the literal Greek, he dropped Judea and of absolute necessity had to go into Samaria. That's how John is explaining it, brothers and sisters. He doesn't tell us what made that necessary. It could be, and I think it possibly is, that he was in a hurry to get into Galilee. Because you see, the Jews didn't travel that way. They did, if they were on their own. Some Jews went up through Samaria if they were going into Galilee. They would go through Samaria if they're on their own. But if they're in company with other Jews, no way. Oh no, that was too much for their dignity. They'd go from Jerusalem, they'd turn right, up over the brow of Olivet, and they'd go down through Jericho, right across the Jordan, and then up the other side with Samaria way over there to their left, with a Jordan valley between them, a mountain range they're on top of, another one, a barrier there, so the smell didn't waft over the valley. Way over there, they'd walk up with their nose in the air, and Samaria would be on their left, and they'd go right up to Galilee, miles out of their way. They'd have to go down 2,500 feet of the valley floor, up the other side another 2,500 to get to the top of Gilead, and then walk along the top of those hills, and come down up the top again, across the valley, and up over the hills of Galilee to get into Galilee. But do all that rather than go through Samaria. But he must needs go through there. Because God's providence, brothers and sisters, would have it to let go Judea and grab Samaria. Now what about Samaria? Samaria really was a city, wasn't it? But it gave its name to the whole district. Actually, the region of Samaria was mainly taken up with the great tribe of Ephraim. There was Judah, which had Jerusalem, of course, and all the environs of Jerusalem and south of Jerusalem. And then a line went through Jerusalem itself, just to the bottom of Jerusalem, and just north of them was Benjamin, which was perched between the great tribes of Ephraim and Judah. And there is little Benjamin in Deuteronomy 33 that God said he put between his shoulders, as he did. He put Judah there and the big Ephraim tribe there, and little Benjamin was perched between their shoulders. That's how it was. And then north of Benjamin, of course, the great tribe of Ephraim taking over the major portion of Samaria. And oftentimes the northern kingdom was called Ephraim. Or Samaria, because that became its capital. It didn't start that way. First capital of the northern kingdom was Tirzah. But Omri, when he came to the throne, who was of course the father of Ahab, moved the capital to Samaria. And the whole district took its name from the city of Samaria, and it became known as the city or the place of the district of Samaria. And again, without turning this up, in the 2nd of Kings, chapter 17, the history of the Samaritans, we read there that the Samaritans really became known as the Samaritans because they dwelt in that district called Samaria. And so there Jesus came to that place, into that district. But he didn't come into Samaria. We read in verse 5 that he came into a place which is called Sychar. And again, you know, there are some people who think that's Shechem, because that's where Jesus was, around about where Shechem was. And Shechem, of course, was another one of those great cities of the Samaritan region, of Samaria. But it isn't Shechem, brothers and sisters. It's Sychar. It's different. It's a little place. But a couple of miles from the site of Shechem. Just a little down south and to the east of the two great mountains, Ebal and Gerizim. And Jesus came to there. Why would he come to Sychar? Well, Sychar is a Hebrew word. It's not a Greek word. Little Hebrew town, known in the Old Testament. You know what it means? It means a drunkard. It has a connotation of being drunk, and because the word means to weave and to stagger as a drunken man, it means to be a liar. And he sat there, brothers and sisters, at a little place that woman came to, because she was a liar, because she belonged to people who told deliberate lies, and they were drunk with their superstition. You know something? That whole district had a reputation for drunkenness. If you ever look at Isaiah 28. In Isaiah 28, that whole district had a reputation for this drunkenness, of which Sychar is the meaning. We read in Isaiah 28, verse 1, "Woe to the crown of pride of the drunkards of Ephraim, whose glorious beauty is a fading flower, which are on the head of the fat valleys of them that are overcome with wine." And so the district of Samaria, or Ephraim as it's there called, was a district which was noted for its drunkenness. Right from back from the days of Ahab, brethren and sisters, who built on the hill of Samaria, 12 miles northwest of Shechem, 12 miles northwest from where our Lord was sitting, on a diagonal track up northwest, there is the city of Samaria, and there Ahab built his ivory palace. And when you go up to Samaria, you wind between the hills of Samaria, which are wider apart and more separate than the hills of Judea, and divided by lovely green valleys. So that a valley sort of just swoops across to the next hill there, and swoops across to that one, undulating towards each mountain. Each mountain seems to be separate. And when you come to Samaria, there's a magnificent valley. It's a beautiful valley that just curves away from you and then rolls up the hill of Samaria. And there is the palace of Ahab, if you can picture it in your mind, the ivory castle of Ahab, sitting on the top of that hill. And with its turrets, of course, its fortress turrets, it looked forever like a jewel and a crown sitting upon the top of that hill at the head of the fat valley, or the fertile valley. And as the eye ran down over that valley, wonderfully fertile, there sparkling in the sun was the ivory palace of Ahab. The drunkards of Ephraim and the crown of pride. And that's what the district was known for. And there was the Samaritan temple, 12 miles back, southeast now, coming back from Samaria, down through the winding track to Shechem. And there was their temple of Gerizim, on top of Gerizim there, sparkling as they thought it would forever go on forever up there. And there they had a reputation for drunkenness, just like the Israelites whom they replaced. And the point the Lord's going to make in this story is this: there's no difference between them and the Jews at all, despite their hostility. And unless they all come to worship God in spirit and in truth, there's no difference. If Ephraim were drunkards, so were the people who inhabit the land now. And sitting there at a little place called Sychar, a drunkard, the Lord's mind would wander back over the prophecy of Isaiah, of which we cannot now speak particularly, but we'll be back there, brethren and sisters, when he gets to Nazareth, because we're going to go back to the 29th chapter of Isaiah, which follows on chronologically in that prophecy as the story in John does. Quite remarkable. We'll be back there, and then we'll make that connection. But for the moment, see him sitting there at Sychar, a place called the Drunkard, and thinking about that district, stupefied as they were with all their superstitions and mixed up religions. And wondering, of course, wondering a great wonder, that God's people down south, that he just let go, were just as bad, if not worse, And yet they'd have nothing to do with that people. Too hoity-toity to pass even through the district, but they were no better, even worse than the people that he'd come to. Think of our Lord's expansive mind. Think of the grandeur of that man. Think of his affinity with his heavenly Father, and think what he thinks, brethren and sisters, about men's opinions of men. You just think what he thinks about that. And sitting there, you enter into his mind. What did he believe? What did he think about the Jews' opinion of that people, or that opinion of Jews, when they were all in desperate need? For all were drunk with the wine and the stupefaction, the flesh, and all that it stood for. The Lord is there to bring them all to come to see the need for the great salvation that he could offer them. Such was the place. And then John adds this magnificent touch. Near to a parcel of ground, which Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Well, there he is, sitting there, between Ebal and Gerizim. And in Genesis 33, brethren and sisters, we have the record of Jacob. This is the spot. You'll appreciate all this when the story gets put together. There's so much wrapped up in the background of this story. We read in Genesis 33 and verse 18. And Jacob came to Shalem, a city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram, and pitched his tent before the city. And he bought a parcel of a field where he'd spread his tent, at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And he erected there an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. The margin, brothers and sisters, may not be accurate to the detail, but in the English it would read what the margin says, God, the God of Israel. And sitting there at Jacob's well, he said to the woman, salvation is of the Jews. God, the God of Israel. He's absolutely right. That water that she was pulling out of that well was telling her, God is the God of Israel. And Jacob had dug that well, and she knew it. Jacob had given them that well. He'd left it to his posterity and to all people who wanted to come and help themselves. He was magnanimous, was Jacob. And out of the goodness of his heart, he gave them the well. Well, here's the gift of God, says Jesus. And if you want to know where the truth is, well, it's the God is the God of Israel. Salvation's of the Jews. The well said that. And he bought that parcel of ground to put that well there, brethren and sisters. He did that. But you see, he bequeathed that later on to Joseph. Genesis 48 and verse 22. Moreover, he said, I have given to thee one portion above thy brethren, which I took out of the hand of the Amorite with my sword and with my bow. And he gave him that one portion extra. And when the tribes of Israel were spread through the land by the instigation of Joshua and the command of Yahweh, brethren and sisters, the big tribe of Ephraim got the center. Manasseh was split in two. He got part of Galilee and he was part over in the land of Gilead. And there was one little spot that God reserved in memory of Joseph. And when Jesus sat there and John recorded, he says he came to a parcel of ground. The Greek means one little spot. That's what the Greek literally means. One tiny spot he left in memory of Joseph. And we're going to see, brethren and sisters, why that was. He left that one little tiny spot. Over in Joshua 24... they buried Joseph there, brethren and sisters. They buried him there. And they brought his bones out of Egypt. According to his faith, by faith Joseph gave commandment concerning his bones. And in Joshua 24 and verse 32, and the bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel brought up out of Egypt, buried they in Shechem, in a parcel of ground, which Jacob bought of the sons of Hamor, and so on. So they buried him there, in a little tiny spot, and there he was. And it's quite remarkable, brethren and sisters, that here is the Lord Jesus Christ sitting at that very spot, there are the bones of Joseph, the one little spot in the earth dedicated to his memory, and he was put there by Joshua, and both of them lived for 110 years of age. Exactly the same amount of time, one buried the other. And they didn't both live together, of course, different epoch, but they both lived for 110, and Joshua put him there in that one little spot. And Joshua told Israel they've got to serve Yahweh in sincerity and in truth. And that's what Jesus said to that woman. And Joshua said to the children of Israel, you're going into a land that is not yours. I'm going to give you fields which you never sowed. You will reap the ground for which you've never labored. And Jesus, looking over the disciples' head and seeing all the Samaritans running out of the city, said, the fields are ready to harvest and you've not put any labor into that. He was reliving those incidents in his mind, brethren and sisters. They were all streaming into that grand mind. You let me tell you some of the things he was thinking. And you'll see them unfold in this story. Look where he was, again, between Ebal and Gerizim, the two mountains. And what did they stand for, brethren and sisters? They stood for decision. Decision. You've got to make a decision. Those two mountains, you make a decision, a blessing or a curse. That woman had to make a decision. It was a burning question. She had to make a decision. This is a very rough turn story. I did it late tonight, but forgive that. Shechem. Doesn't mean decisions, it means a burden bearer. But it's so worded to mean that one's got to accept one's responsibilities. You've got to bear your own burden. You've got to make a decision. In the 12th chapter of Genesis and verse 6, Abraham came out of Ur of the Chaldees and he came into the land of Shechem. And the first mention of the Bible in Shechem, it says this, the Canaanite was then in the land. He had a choice. So Abraham could dwell in that land, he could be a stranger in a country that was not him, or he could be a Canaanite. The decision was his. We come to Genesis 35, when Jacob came back from Syria with his family. And he knew that they got mixed up in idolatry in Syria. They thought he didn't know, but he did know. And when he got them to Shechem, he said, put away the strange gods from among you. They had to make a decision, to serve God or mammon. In Judges chapter 9, brothers and sisters, all Israel took Abimelech, who was one of the sons of Gideon by his concubine. Didn't have a right to the line of the throne that they offered Gideon. Gideon didn't want to be king, but they wanted to make one of his sons king. So this chap had all his sons slain. And Israel took him to Shechem and made a decision to have him, instead of the legitimate sons of Gideon, to be their king. And that decision, brothers and sisters, fell around their ears in a most shocking manner. Moses took the children of Israel there, we read, in the book of Deuteronomy. Or rather, Joshua did by the commandment of Moses. Moses commanded that they would go there, and he put six tribes on Gerizim, six on Mount Ebal, and the priest stood in the middle, and they chanted the blessings and the curse, and they could have whatever they wanted. They had to make a decision. What do you want? And when Joshua finally gave up his life, brothers and sisters, at the same age as Joseph, he brought Israel to the very spot where that man was buried. And he says, choose ye this day whom ye will serve. It was still a question of making a decision, wasn't it? And up comes a woman and says, what do we do? And the Lord, brothers and sisters, was to put before her the alternatives. And it wasn't just a question as to whether that mountain or that mountain was the place of true worship. The question, brothers and sisters, was whether true worship was in there or it wasn't. And that's the biggest decision in life. And the last incident that we know about Ebal and Gerizim is the one we're going to study. And when you realize that you've got all that, and more, I've just made a selection. When you realize that the whole of the Old Testament, as far as Shechem is concerned, is a piling up of decisions, the greatest decision you and I have got to make is to whether we're going to serve God in there or not. That's the biggest decision in life. And that's what the woman, brothers and sisters, that's the decision that she had to make. But what about this spot of Joseph's? Why would John bother to tell us, near to the little spot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph? And I want to finish this study this evening, brothers and sisters, by telling you why that is. And when we've finished all this, and you go home and think about it all, because you're going to have another number of weeks, I believe, before we're back again, because Golden Grove can interfere. But if we, I don't mean that way, but when we come back next time, you've got to remember all this background, because we're going to relate that to that story. Now, why would he bring him to the spot where Joseph was buried? What's Joseph got to do with this? Very much indeed. First of all, because that woman, when it suited her, claimed to be a descendant of Joseph. Jesus knew that was not true. But he also knew this, brothers and sisters, which I found out some years ago now, which was a big thrill to me. He also knew this, that if she ever came into the truth, which she did, she would be especially the seed of Joseph, above any other of the sons of Israel. Above any other, it would be Joseph. Why? Well, you see, it all goes like this. You just follow this with me. It's absolutely scintillating, this is. Near to a spot of ground that Jacob gave to Joseph, and up comes this woman of Samaria. This is Psalm 80. You follow this. Give ear, O shepherd of Israel, thou that leadest Joseph like a flock, thou that dwellest between the cherubim, shine forth before Ephraim and Benjamin and Manasseh. Stir up thy strength and come and save us. Incredible, brothers and sisters, isn't it? Here's the shepherd of Israel. But he's not leading all the tribe. He's leading what the psalm likes to call Joseph like a flock. And he mentions three of the tribes, Ephraim, Benjamin, and Manasseh. Ephraim and Manasseh happen to be the two sons of Joseph. And Benjamin, brothers and sisters, is his only full-blooded brother. So in these three tribes, we have the flock of Joseph. But more than that, if the shepherd of Israel is leading the flock of Joseph, and there they are in those three tribes, we know this, that if he's going forth from between the cherubim, and I'll put that back there again, note that, thou that dwellest between the cherubim, if he's between the cherubim, and he's a shepherd, his flock would be behind him. Well, the shepherd would be going east. And behind him was Benjamin, Manasseh, and Ephraim. There is the flock of Joseph. If the shepherd goes before his flock, as he did, there they are following him. But you will note a difference. A keen Bible reader would have noted a difference. Because the psalmist said, from before Ephraim, Benjamin, and Manasseh. That's not how they're put there. And what the psalmist did, he brought Benjamin to the centre. Why? Because Benjamin means the son of my right hand. And in Psalm 80, verse 17, it says, let thy hand be upon the man of thy right hand. So the psalmist moves him to the centre. So whoever is the flock of Joseph, we know that Benjamin is the son of God's right hand. And if God, as he is, the shepherd of Israel, there's only one person who ever went right behind God, and that was Jesus Christ, the son of his right hand. But either side of him were two tribes who belonged to Joseph. Now, what was special about them in the record, brothers and sisters? You read with me Genesis 48, and you'll begin to see why it was that Jesus spoke to that woman on that spot, that little spot on earth. Genesis 48. Jacob is about to pass into the article of death. He's seen Joseph again, and he brings the two boys of Joseph before him, and in verse 5 of Genesis 48 he says, and now thy two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, which were born unto thee in the land of Egypt, before I came into Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. And thy issue, which thou begettest after them, shall be thine, and shall be called after the name of their brethren, their inheritance. In other words, Joseph, you can have whatever family comes from this point on. Those two boys are mine. and says Jacob, they were born to you in Egypt before I ever came there. So here were two boys born in Egypt that never knew a thing about Israel and that were adopted into the family of Israel, brethren and sisters. Who is the flock of Joseph? They're people born in Egypt who, when they were born and reared, never knew Israel at all. They would have heard from Joseph, of course, but as in reality, never knew him. But in the end, they were adopted. And Joseph's name means the increaser. And Jesus sat thus in Jacob's well, near to the little spot on the earth that Jacob gave to his son Joseph, and up come a woman of Samaria. Imagine what that mind was thinking, sitting there, brothers and sisters, with that flooding into his mind. He would look at that woman, he would know straight away there was about to be an adoption. There was about to be an adoption. Literally, Joseph, brethren and sisters, the literal Joseph, who was there with Jacob, had another issue. They were his own. But the one sitting on Jacob's well was Benjamin, the son of God's right hand. And his issue, his seed, brethren and sisters, was not like the literal Joseph's who had it to himself. He was the son of God's right hand. And if those two boys were adopted into God's family, he was God's son. And sitting there between, as it were, those two tribes, he waited for that woman to come to him, and she was going to be adopted. Now, if you think that is not right, and I know you don't, just have a look at this. In the fourth chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, brethren and sisters, this will begin, I hope you'll understand the import of what's going on in the fourth chapter of John when this woman came up to be adopted. We read about another Joseph in the fourth chapter of the Acts of the Apostles. You might know this man by the name of Joseph, but you know him well by the name of Barnabas. But that wasn't his proper name. In the last two verses of Acts chapter 4, verse 36, and Joseph, or Joseph as it is in the Hebrew, that's the Greek press of Joseph, and Joseph, who was by the apostles named Barnabas, the apostles called him that, which being interpreted the son of consolation or exhortation, a Levite, and of the country of Cyprus, having land, sold it, and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. Look at him, brethren and sisters. Here's Joseph, but this Joseph is a Levite. His inheritance is Yahweh. He doesn't own any land under the law of Moses. Yahweh was his portion. But this Levite didn't even live in the land. He lived way out on the island of Cyprus, away from the land. Who, when he came to the land of Israel, he owned land. He sold it and gave it away. Because he knew the spirit of the Levites. They weren't to have an inheritance. Yahweh was their inheritance. He believed that. He was called Joseph. What did they use him for in the ecclesia, brethren and sisters? Joseph means the increaser. The increaser of the family of God by adoption. Acts 11. Just listen to this. The family of Joseph is spreading out. The flock of Joseph is coming from everywhere. The children of God are being gathered together that are scattered abroad, as John puts it. Gentiles are coming into the truth at Antioch. We read in verse 22 of Acts 11, then tidings of these things came unto the ears of the ecclesia, which was in Jerusalem. You know, brethren and sisters, let's pause there. That wouldn't have been welcome news. That would have been fear and trepidation. Message came down from Antioch in Syria. Hey, Gentiles are pouring into the truth. Oh, trouble. Look, we've got to be careful. Let's be careful. Let's hold them at bay. Let's hold it up. Let's not be too quick about this. They'd be worried about that, brethren and sisters. But they said in that verse, and they sent forth Barnabas, that he should go as far as Antioch, who when he came and saw the grace of God was glad. There would have been some Jews, brethren and sisters, that were sad. But he was glad, and he exhorted them all that with purpose of heart they would cleave unto the Lord. For he was a good man, full of the Holy Spirit and of faith, and much people was added. under the law. He increased the family of God by adoption from the Gentiles. People who were born in spiritual Egypt and had never known Israel but became adopted. That's what Joseph stood for, brothers and sisters. And there he is, sitting on the well, in the place of the drunkards, between Ebal and Gerizim, in a little spot on the earth that God gave to his son Joseph, and up comes the woman of Samaria. Now that's the background of the story. Just think about it. In the next few weeks, keep on thinking about it. Just keep thinking about it. Jesus letting go Judea, dropping it, grasping opportunities of a necessity having to go to Samaria, whatever that necessity was, there it was, forcing him through Samaria. He comes to this spot on the earth, sits between those two great mountains, the blessing and the curse. Have a choice, whatever, which one do you want? Sitting on that well, which said, God is the God of Israel, salvation to the Jews. Knowing that the world, brothers and sisters, was a gift given not only to Jacob's family, but to whoever wanted to participate in the water could have it. Knowing this too, that he lived in a land of drunks who needed desperately to get back to a bit of aqua pura. And sitting there, right over the littlest spot on the earth, a tiny little spot that was reserved for the memory of the man who increased the family of God by adoption, and with all that history, with all that geography, up comes a woman of Samaria. And a conversation ensued, brothers and sisters, which swirled around all that circumstances. And by magnificent allusions, drawing out the implication of words, and leading that simple woman's mind on and on and on, Jesus turned her, brethren and sisters, into a loose, immoral woman. He turned her from that into a woman who worshipped Yahweh in sincerity and in truth.
We will bring our class to a conclusion, brethren and sisters, with this singing of hymn number 129, followed by a word of prayer. Hymn number 129.